Good evening. This is Mae Bressel. It's KAZU-FM in Pacific Grove, California. It's broadcast number 676, November the 19th, 1984. We go over and review what was happening a year ago this week. I like to do that and share that with you. That was broadcast 624, November 21st, 1983, on the 20th anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Larry Flint was to get out a magazine called The Rebel. I did the original opening story for it. It was on the Fourth Reich and the Kennedy assassination. And I don't know how many of you listeners have it, but I can make copies and let you know what the cost is if you want it. The Rebel isn't published anymore. It was a very important article on the years of the war period, during the war, even before we got into the war, from 1940 to 45, we weren't in it till 41, the role of John J. McCloy, Allen Dulles, Charles Willoughby, J. Edgar Hoover, and the transition from the United States OSS to the CIA and the use of Reinhard Gehlen into the United States intelligence system and the role that they played as they built their power base, eventually in Dallas, Texas, where John Kennedy was murdered, the links of specific Nazis to the Kennedy assassination, and members of the Warren Commission who were close with those Nazis, and the role of putting them on the commission when Allen Dulles and John J. McCloy, when they worked so carefully with Nazi war criminals, and John J. McCloy had released many of them, who then came back and played some part in the assassination of John Kennedy. As soon as Larry Flint got this idea of The Rebel and the magazine out, he was completely infiltrated with agents, and I was discussing that a year ago on the program, saying a couple of house guests moved in and mentioned Gordon Novell and Mitchell Werbel. Well, after November, it kept getting worse, and there was G. Gordon Liddy and Timothy Leary. I called them the A-team moved in. As a matter of fact, on the telephone a few weeks ago, Gordon Novell had called David Emery up north while he was on a radio program. And off the air, he said, yes, I did, and Larry Flint. Those guys were there to stop the Rebel, stop Larry Flint's work into politics that he started once before a few years ago and was shot. This time, Larry and his wife were drugged. And the first time I noticed that he was really drugged and losing his mind was November the 12th, 1983. And I told him that, but he had to run the full course because when you are drugged, you can't get that message across to a person. Their mind is blocked out and it's difficult to receive it. It was a very difficult year. A lot of hopes went into the Rebel, a lot of disappointment and sadness, a year of turmoil and watching what happened to Larry Flint being destroyed, like you take the wings off of an insect. He got into the big league with this kind of publication. This is very important material he was printing. And he wasn't careful enough about the people that he let into the Hustler over at Century City or into his home. And the whole thing came crashing down. Now, there's a story today in the Chronicle, San Francisco Chronicle Examiner, and also yesterday's paper that I'm briefly going to mention, and I'm going to do a lot more on it next week. But I wanted to stick mostly with the Kennedy assassination on the 21st anniversary of Kennedy's assassination and share new information with you and linking it to Ronald Reagan's past and his early religious fundamentalist backing that he had long before he was president and before he was even governor. But the article that's in the paper has to do with the actor Rossano Brazzi. You may have seen that in your newspapers around the country. B-R-A-Z-Z-I. He was well known in the movie South Pacific, Three Coins and a Fountain, and other pictures, and he has been indicted for smuggling in Rome. This five-year investigation has whispered about his name before, but now he's been brought in as a co-defendant with Bekir Selenk, C-E-L-E-N-K, Selenk, the fellow that has also been charged on the plot to kill Pope John Paul II, working with Mr. Aja, one of the major people in that assassination plot. Mr. Brazzi has been indicted. Now he has been charged with conspiring to sell missiles and tanks and advanced weapons and atomic bombs to various Arab countries. And the two of them, Brazzi and Selenk, are involved not only with the weapons, but, as I say, there was the assassination attempt on the Pope. Now, trying to get the Pope would have triggered, if they had done it, would have triggered World War III. If you could link it to the Soviets and the Bulgarians and say that the Soviets were responsible for what the Bulgarian agents did. And the other part of this story is the Armageddon that we're hearing about so much from Ronald Reagan and the fundamentalist preachers. But well-known people such as Mr. Rosano Brazzi, who is a friend of Ronald Reagan's, an associate of Frank Sinatra, known each other since 1948, going back those long early days. Brazzi is tied up to the P2, the Masonic Lodge, to Mussolini's terror squad, Cilicio Gelli, and to the assassination of the Pope, the attempt on the Pope, and selling atomic weapons to Arab nations that could start over in Israel the Armageddon. This is a convoluted, complicated story of individuals, some names I've had on the program before, but I'll do more on it because it really takes 1 hour just as a starter, and maybe I'll do a 2 or 3 part program on it, but that is in the news right now. Another story that you can look for, I worry about, talked about before, surfaced in Houston, Texas, not in the newspaper, but in front of the courthouse. A subscriber to these broadcasts, a friend who sends me articles every single week, just marvelous packets from the Houston Post, you see me quoting it all the time, told me about somebody who went to the courthouse, had jury duty last week, and saw young kids, I don't know the age, passing out flyers and getting signatures for a petition to change the Constitution to allow Henry Kissinger to run for President of the United States. Are you ready for that one? I knew that would be happening. Remember in the early 70s, I said Ronald Reagan would be running for President of the United States, and I was practically booed off the stages where I was speaking at different places because the audience was sure that Nelson Rockefeller would be President of the United States. Well, Rockefeller ended in the grave, and Reagan was President. So if I was right about that one, you better watch the next one, because how do we know that this isn't the offing? I know it positively is. Now, one of the things that is really scary about this is that the budget, the deficit that's so huge, I believe it's being allowed to get out of hand, the military spending, various spendings, way off the top of what we can't even pay the interest on at this point. And it will get so bad that there will be a demand from the Democrats and Republicans for a constitutional convention. And when the convention is called, that's when they're going to slip in the amendment that changes the Constitution that a foreign-born can't be president of the United States. And then we will have the Fuhrer, Henry Kissinger, and the armbands and goose step will begin. And you'll find that he isn't the Jew boy or the little Jew that Fritz Kramer talked about, but he's the Nazi behind the various movements in all the countries that I run down over and over again. Just see your morning's paper. Here's one article. Troops round up the male population of Shantytown. Chilean sees 3,000 young men. This is what Henry Kissinger gave you. If you have to remind it every day of what's going on, Chile is one of his great accomplishments. So in Houston, Texas, of all places, the home of conservatism, fundamentalism, and all that goes down there with the H.L. Hunts and the Brown and Roots and the John Connollys and the who's who of the assassination team, out of Houston, Texas, the petitions wanting little Henry Kissinger to be the President of the United States. I'm not shocked, and I am shocked. I just have to pass that on. Now, I want to go to a few items on the assassination of Mrs. Gandhi before we go on to the John Kennedy material, because I don't want to lose track of some very important articles that have come out this past week that you might not have seen or heard about. NBC had a program, this is November the 17th, 1984, 5:45 News, the main national news, and they mentioned on the program that there was a large plot to kill Mrs. Gandhi planned long before May or June. It had nothing to do with going into the Golden Temple. She was going to be murdered, and this was arranged ahead of time. And as I said before, these assassination plots hatch 3 or 4 years ahead. If this system and NATO and the president want to kill Andres Papandreou, they're planning it now. They're setting their agents now because he isn't a good boy not doing what they want. So I knew that this was planned a long time ago and that they created the excuse for killing her and the motives for killing her, as I said, they did with John Kennedy and the Bay of Pigs. And I said there was that 4 year lapse, or 1960 to the end of 1963, almost 4 years, when the planning wheels went in motion to kill John Kennedy. So this information on NBC confirms what I know is happening and have mentioned to you before, how long and complicated it is to do these things. But if you've studied them, as I have for 20 years, it takes you about 2 weeks to figure out where it's coming from. The San Francisco Chronicle had a story November 17th. India asked Norway to extradite a Sikh. Mr. Harinder Singh, S-H-A-R-I-N-D-E-R, I don't have to use the last name. That is the appropriate name for all of the Sikhs. As I mentioned before, they have that last name. He's deputy chief of the Indian embassy in Oslo, Norway, and they've asked him, there's been an appeal, and asked him to come back, not get political asylum in Norway, because his name has been mentioned, and the survivor of the two assassination teams right on the ground there evidently mentioned his name. They want Harinder Singh from Norway. That's one of the assassination team members that is overseas that they want. New Times from the Soviet Union had a story in August before Mrs. Gandhi was murdered. $1 million for the murder. Yes, £1 million in sterling, not rupees, but £1 million has been offered by Chauhan, C-H-A-U-H-N, I mentioned him last week from London, who has offered $1 million while back for the murder of Mrs. Gandhi. He wants his cash, and he says, this article in the New Times says that he is familiar with American dollars. With the CIA, he has more than once bragged of being on intimate terms and in the pay of the CIA. And then it goes on to say that his mission, another person that they wanted, the international terrorist Paramit Singh, P-A-R-A-M-I-I-T, his mission of Paramit, not Chauhan, the other one, there's two. Paramit was to go into the temple to meet with Binrandwale, the fellow that was murdered, and meet him secretly and then murder Mrs. Gandhi. So the plan was to murder Mrs. Gandhi, and the million was offered before Mr. Binrandwale was killed, unless he was killed inside the Golden Temple by one of his own, as our CIA manual suggests to the guerrillas and the terrorists, to create a martyr. But his mission was to go there and meet with him. And then his next target was to be India's President Zail, Z-A-I-L, Singh, S-I-N-G-H, again. And he would be sent by the Foreign Secret Service, this terrorist operation, for killing in India. And they would draw this huge amount of money and a check. And this report has to do with the Delhi airport where somebody was arrested, Mr. Jagir Singh, J-A-G-I-R, on July 20th. And he had plotted with others to assassinate the leaders in the country and work with the conspirators, and said that he received money from the United States, a CIA agent with a question mark. And most likely, this article says, as I say, this is from New Times magazine, $1 million for a murder, and mentions three different people that were involved with the plot. The Washington Times has a story November 16th. The accused links foreigners to the Gandhi plot. That is the survivor who is talking now. He's left the hospital and he's now been taken to a jail. But he is talking about the plans to kill Mrs. Gandhi. And he claimed that the extremists got their support from Sikh separatists based in Britain, the United States, Canada, and West Germany. The survivor of the two assassins, didn't claim that in India. They were claiming that, and Mrs. Gandhi was claiming that. And as I mentioned last week, one of the men who arranged for the two killers to be in a certain position did leave for Canada, but they're looking, as I say, in Norway. Lots of luck. I'm sure it'll be hard to find in Canada the American trained Sikh that got extradited there, or many of the others who around the world, well-trained assassination teams, and they know how to hit, and they know how to leave their patsies, and they have good mind control and good motivations. The kamikaze concept is alive and well, and the planners are home free again. The Washington Post had a long article, almost half a page, Moscow seeing continuing propaganda, hints of U.S. role in Gandhi death. Now, Ronald Reagan, according to this article, is simply furious. He says he deeply resented the Kremlin suggesting that the United States was involved with the hit on Mrs. Gandhi. The Soviets risk, this is a quote, damaging very severely any hope of improving U.S. relations if they keep up that campaign. Now, if the Soviet Union finds that we have killed a political person, such as even our own president, John Kennedy, or say Mrs. Gandhi. If they mention it, then the president says, well, there's no chance of us getting along with you. We'll need more weapons to fight you if you're going to keep that talk. But for their own safety and for their own true historic purposes, if they want such a thing, or if they want to put us on the line for killing these people, in addition to having the manual on how to kill, it seems to be working. The president is showing that he's angry about this kind of talk. Now, the Washington Post says in the past, India is a fertile ground for Soviet disinformation, and they talked about a secret cable by U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Jean Kirkpatrick, outlining a U.S. strategy to promote the Balkanization of India and thereby subvert Indian influence in the region. Now, they say it was forged, but I'm not sure it was forged, and we don't know if it was forged. That sounds just like Jean Kirkpatrick would want to do it. She's in charge of our Central American policies and has a good job of sabotaging and Balkanizing those places. So because the Washington Post says that's a forged document, doesn't necessarily mean that they didn't pick up a conversation or a meeting that Jean Kirkpatrick went to. In fact, they said they lifted it out of context and altered it in a false cable. But I'm sure verbatim or out of context, the intent was that, and that's what they put together, what she was saying about India long before Mrs. Gandhi was killed. The Washington Post talks about the problem the United States will have irritating India with weapons for Pakistan, and that the U.S. banks, the foreign banks, don't want to give loans to India. There's opposition to Asian Development Bank loans to India. And so the United States wants to show, we'll get along, we like you, we can work with Rajiv, but we still have the problem of weapons for Pakistan and not giving money for them to have the same benefits the other countries have. A story in the Christian Science Monitor, Gandhi killers, why weren't they kept away? And this talks about the man who gave the first three shots and then the other one who had the final blast. And BNT is the survivor of the two men who shot at Mrs. Gandhi. He gave just three quick shots, and then she got a whole barrage from the other gunman. And this article says that he was unknown to Mrs. Gandhi, and on the morning of her murder, he was facing her. But on the other side of the gate, unknown to Mrs. Gandhi, was Satwant Singh, the fellow who was killed on the spot, and he was new to her staff. I guess he got the Lee Harvey Oswald treatment right there. He had just been with her a short time. He was new on the staff. He had returned on duty just the Monday before she was killed. He spent 2 months in the Punjab area, and there was even talk that his brother had been killed in the Golden Temple. So this was what the fellow who was taking all the shots at her and had been hired just as a new guard. And boy, you can be suspicious at a time of trouble having new guards and not checking them out thoroughly or what they were doing to their summer vacation. The same day that Ms. Gandhi died, there was an article in the Washington Times, Pakistan close to completing atomic arms, the report states. They're on the verge of joining the world's nuclear club. They're capable of building atomic bombs that could trigger reaction in neighboring India to develop nuclear arms. So the day that she was killed, this report was released from the Carnegie Endowment for an International Peace that Pakistan now had atomic bombs, and here was Reagan and China getting ready to develop militarily the weapon system there. As a matter of fact, this week, Alexander Haig flew to China to deliver airplanes, fighter planes to China. He went personally to see that they were in place and delivered and have a little party to celebrate China receiving these airplanes, the Sikorsky airplanes that are made by United Technology that he was president of and is still affiliated with. Another story, 12 days after her death, the Wall Street Journal, Pakistan seeking $91 million credit for Boeing airplanes. So Pakistan wants the Western banks this week, now that Mrs. Gandhi's out of the way and India's destabilized and Pakistan delivered, if the Pakistanis trained for the CIA, the Sikhs that killed Mrs. Gandhi, there won't be anything stopping anything they want, because they can then blackmail the United States like all the other countries do very nicely. So 12 days after she's killed and delivered, they've asked for $91 million, and they're going to buy Boeing 737 jets. And I'll tell you, I'll bet you anything it goes through. The article says there's some question about the third world debt, but this third world delivered, and so now they can escalate the arms of Pakistan, hoping then, of course, to use them against Afghanistan and the Soviet Union from that vantage point. November 14th, another story, secret arrest in the assassination of Gandhi. The police commando that she had was held and arrested the day that she was shot. Jagtar Singh, J-A-G-T-A-R, who was in charge of her security. He has been involved in what they call a criminal conspiracy hatch for the assassination of Mrs. Gandhi. Isn't it interesting, 21 years after the murder of John Kennedy, how fast they're getting into these assassination teams, such as the one in the Philippines of Aquino and also of Mrs. Gandhi. They're working much faster now. They're not taking so many years to find out who the assassins are. Now, I do want to make one or two comments about Svetlana Stalin going home. It was quite a coincidence that the day that she went into the Soviet Union was the exact day that Mrs. Gandhi was shot in India. And the excuse for Svetlana leaving the Soviet Union in the first place, that she had a friend, a Sikh, a close friend, in quotes, who lived in India. And when he died, she took the ashes over to India in December 1966 on the excuse that she wanted to put the ashes in the Ganges as a religious service. And I, at the time, I had the feeling that he probably was murdered so that she could, this man died young, so that she would have an excuse to leave the Soviet Union, and our CIA Galen agents in the Soviet would have a major coup, you know, getting her over here and into the United States. So she went over the border and went to New Delhi, stayed there a couple of months, and then was in the arms of the CIA in March 1967. But I believe those 2 months, January and February, were all prearranged, because then she went to Switzerland and flew to the home of Priscilla Johnson McMillan, who was in charge of her most of the time, and dragged her around. And in the London Times, she said that her CIA minders considered her their private property and a personal pet. And she says, said in another syndicated story across the country, that she literally had no mind of her own, that they followed her. They, every single day for 17 years, she didn't have a free moment. The CIA told her what to say, what to do, how to write, and she had been an author and has a mind of her own, and she really resented it. She wrote in the London Times a letter for potential defectors from the Soviet Union to think again. She said, every defector imagines that there beyond the border in the fierce free world, in the free world, are people that are superhuman, wise, enlightened, not like our poor lot in the USSR. And what a terrible blow it is to find out on the other side of the world they are the same idiots, incompetent fools, frightened bureaucrats, confused bosses, paranoid fears of deception and surveillance, and all of that on the other side of the Iron Curtain. She said the discovery made a loss of idealism. You shouldn't try to come over here. Don't think of the free world as a great thing. She says there's too much propaganda telling you what goes on over there, and it isn't like you think that it is, and I'm sure the CIA watched her very, very closely. Now, Priscilla Johnson McMillan is the woman who saw Lee Harvey Oswald in the Soviet Union. She was the CIA contact through the embassy and through the hotel when he first arrived in the Soviet Union. And I'm sure she had some way of placing him into that Minsk radio factory. We'll never know how or what. But there were Aline Mosby, there were several writers of the CIA, and many in the embassy, of course. But after Lee Harvey Oswald was killed in Dallas, Marina Oswald went right to the custody of Priscilla Johnson within a very few months. And Priscilla Johnson McMillan took her to Sedona, Arizona. And I mentioned this before, several years ago on the program. And there were allegations of people that I knew in Sedona and got letters of mind control programs in a trailer camp. And we visited Sedona when she was there with Priscilla Johnson. And when the book Marina and Lee came out, allegedly written by Marina Oswald, but it was Priscilla Johnson McMillan, and they were doing television shows. They were so pathetic. I think I taped some of them. And she would tell on the television how Lee Oswald beat his wife. And the person interviewing would say to Marina, did he? And she says, well, I don't know. If Priscilla said so, he did. None of the facts that Priscilla was saying made any sense to Marina Oswald, but she sat there and Priscilla bobbed her head back and forth. And had total control of the interviews and Marina Oswald and Svetlana Stalin. Now, I want to do some more on the Kennedy assassination because, as I say, it is the anniversary. And when I get out the material to do it, I just love working on that. I spent 9 years on those Warren Commission hearings and 20 years in all. And when I get out those pages, I really smile. I realize how important it is for me to get a book out on this stuff. And new resolution, January the 1st, I'll do some work. I'll write on the Kennedy assassination because it's time now. It's 21 years, and it's a full circle from the, as I say, the Nazi Germany to CIA and to Dallas and to Ronald Reagan. And with Reagan elected for 4 more years and with the fundamentalists coming out of the woodwork at the Republican National Convention and the role of Falwell and Robeson and the preachers and their work with the Defense Department, now it's very clear what happened, how it happened, who was involved, and it's much easier to sit down and write a book and feel satisfied that all the other pieces that you don't have will fit into the structure that you have, and so far that has been true of all my work. Now, the Warren Report is always fun to read, and the minutes of the Warren Commission meetings are even greater. I'd like to write a play and just have people read these lines on the stage. But at the January 21st meeting of the Warren Commission, Alan Dulles was talking to the staff, members of the Warren Commission, about how much material he had. And he complained. He said, this is a quote. Now, this is Alan Dulles of the OSS, the CIA, who brought in the Galen agents, the Nazis, fired by John Kennedy, put back on the Warren Commission, not trusted by Kennedy. When Kennedy's killed, he's put there to investigate who killed him. And this is what he's saying to the gang there at one of their first meetings. They haven't heard any witnesses yet. He said, I wonder if our staff could take this tremendous mass. I've been down here a couple of days, and it is just perfectly tremendous. And two-thirds of it is of no importance. And in the sense that people say they knew something about this, and then you take them, and they don't know anything. If the staff could pick up what they think is essential, I think we could rely on them because it is tremendous. Also important in the staff is that they were all cleared by the Central Intelligence Agency, and they agreed to have pregnant girls from the CIA who couldn't be active in the field. They could be working on this massive material and then go back to the agency after they finished the job. He said, the amount of material we have is as high as this room, the raw reports and the other reports. And he said, I don't think the members of this commission, ourselves, without devoting all our time and more, could ever read all this stuff. And J. Lee Rankin, the attorney for the Warren Commission, said, I think it would take 30 days to read it and digest it. Well, I'll tell you, it took me 9 years with no radio broadcast to work and read it and digest it, and it has taken me another 12 years to reread it and see things that didn't ring a bell the first time and digest what this massive amount of material amounted to. Now, J. Lee Rankin thinks it would take 30 days. I don't know whether that includes your Saturdays or Sundays off. The FBI had narrowed down that material that they didn't destroy to 25,000 interviews, 2,300 reports, 25,400 pages of documents. The Secret Service had another 5,550 interviews, 800 reports, and 4,600 pages. So that must be pretty good speed reading for 30 days, but that's what they were going to allow themselves, the luxury of looking into who killed John Kennedy and then telling you and having the information in 30 days. Now, the Torba document I referred to many times, it came out in 1970, a very important document written by David Copeland, an attorney in Texas who worked with various people involved in the assassination or part of the assassination. And he wrote this. It's privately published for researchers, and it was duplicated, and you can get copies from research out in Aptos. In the Torbett document, I'm going to take one or two pages and then go on to more current documents just to cite some of this information. One of the matters they go into at great length in there is the group, the Solidaris. And they are described in the Torbett document as the Solidaris are a vast number of agents within Russia, and they have a common anti-communist objective with J. Edgar Hoover. They worked continuously with the Anacostia Cubans, who considered that their country was filled with an occupying force. So the Cuban exiles and the Solidaris wanting to take back the Soviet Union, the Cuban exiles take back Cuba, and Division 5 of the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover worked closely with them. Now, We'll take a 1-minute break and then continue on with the Solidaris and Marina Oswald.